031702.
It's just gone 25 minutes to 10 o'clock. This is the Karima Brown Show. You are listening to 702. Now, Zimbabwe's internet connection, which was shut down on yesterday, is now back on after the country's president, who was in Moscow, called for peace and calm as deadly protests in the country continues. Businesses and schools were shut down and public transport vehicles were grounded in most of the country, despite the government's assurances that security would be provided. The government over the weekend announced a fuel price hike of over 150%. This means gasoline in Zimbabwe is now the most expensive in the world, based on data from globalpetrolprice.com. Well, joining me now to unpack the very latest developments in Zimbabwe and to make sense of all of this and how Zimbabwe can possibly extract itself from this and get on a different path, I am joined by Professor Brian Raftopoulos. He's a veteran political analyst and the Director of Research and Advocacy for Zimbabwe, Zimbabwean NGO Solidarity Peace Trust. Professor Raftopoulos, good evening. Welcome to the program.
Good evening, Karima. Thank you for having me on the program again.
Now, I can't start this interview without telling you what my son told me this afternoon. He said the first thing, he said, "Mom, do you know how ridiculous the Zimbabwean president was? He tweeted a message whilst his country was cut off from all social media." I mean, like, what is that? Is that evil? Is that stupidity? What is it? And of course, I had no answer for him. But what was also interesting was that he was contacting his Zimbabwean friends in South Africa and checking whether they were able to get a hold of their families. And what they did was they actually did what was called a Twitter blast. And within a few hours, they managed to get so many retweets that news agencies actually started picking up the information and running with the stories. And, you know, by the time I came into work, which was about around about 5 o'clock, my son said, maybe our little activism helped. You know, it looks like the internet is back on in Zimbabwe. Now, it sounds very anecdotal, but I mean, the idea to switch the internet off was obviously to try and prevent people from organizing get-togethers and so on. But people find ways of communicating. People find ways of making even silence speak.
Absolutely. I mean, your comment by your son is just a description of the kind of lack of sense of irony by authoritarian regimes. They have no sensitivity to these issues. And, of course, they've become very sensitive about the social media since 2016 and this flag movement and the new kind of forces that have emerged outside of the old civil society groupings. Mm. And they become very effective at spreading those messages. The shutdown was an attempt, of course, to try and close that down.
Yeah. What was really interesting for me was the fact that, you know, the Zimbabwean trade unions have been out of stuff for a very long time. We've had party political activities, breakaways with the MDC and so on. But this stay away was actually initiated by the trade union movement in Zimbabwe, and people were supporting right from the beginning. Is there a reorganization of the political opposition, if you like, beyond the kind of ones that we know, the factional groups in the MDC and so on? There's a lot of emphasis on Mr. Nelson Chamisa, but are other people beginning to come to the party? Is this the political landscape changing as we also see the fight within ZANU-PF is, of course, far from over? We know that the chief of the army and Mr. Emmerson Mnangagwa is not sitting around the same fire. I mean, is this the result of a kind of internal wrangling within both the opposition and the ruling elite?
Well, I think the MDC took a deliberate decision not to be at the forefront and be seen to be at the forefront, although I'm sure they were all involved in different ways.
Yeah.
And therefore, the trade unions took the front seat. But what's interesting is that this trade union activity started in the public sector, where most of the formal sector workers are.
Yeah.
And so the strike by the doctors, the nurses, the teachers, this was the most important trigger of pushing the unions to the fore. But I think the people who came out on the street, of course, most of these are unemployed youth working in the informal sector. They're not part of formal trade union structures.
Yeah.
And so in some sense, watching the activities, it seems to me also that the organizers of this kind of lost control of the momentum of this activity.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got different agendas playing out in the context of what happened there.
Now, of course, this is normally what happens in a power vacuum. You have various forces swirling around, and sometimes one can have quite hectic consequences. You can have the rise of populism. You can have the rise of narrow nationalism and a kind of ethnic revival of the way in which people understand politics, the emergence of strong men and women in times like this. In your, estimation, Professor Raftopoulos, what is the state of play with the Mnangagwa government? How solid is Mr. Mnangagwa's position within ZANU-PF, and is he in charge?
Look, I think once the coup took place, there was always a sense of insecurity that followed that, that if this could happen with Mugabe, it could happen another time. And the lack of legitimacy which resulted from the election last year and the continued problems which Mnangagwa has had in selling his legitimacy, I think keeps him on the edge. I think, though, that this is not, we're not likely to see another coup. Now, what we're likely to see is just the military consolidating themselves again in the state, in the society. And one of the results of this might be now a kind of repressive response to this and using this as an excuse. As we've already seen, people have been arrested, they've been shot, people are leaving the country again. This could be the excuse to consolidate. But it's not in the long run. It's not going to serve the purpose of reform for this government.
And it's unsustainable. I mean, when we were talking the last time, there was this sense that even though Emmerson Mnangagwa has been the handmaiden of President Mugabe, or former President Mugabe, he was the butcher in massacres in Bateleland. There was a sense that he's a pragmatist, that business people could do business with him, and that he would be able to kind of give that sense of stability. But I mean, it was a very fragile arrangement and based on a set of assumptions that were far from solidly grounded. I mean, if anything, the situation is incredibly fluid in Zimbabwe, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think all that rhetoric around political and economic reform, it's certainly been seen to be quite empty. The economy is in a much worse position than it was in 2017. The kind of political outreach which he had hoped to get with the West is not happening.
Yes.
And so for him, the crisis is deepening. He hoped that his trip to Russia would bring in some new investment, particularly in the mineral side. Mm. But with regard to the kind of investment, the debt issue that is there, these issues are not going to move forward. The situation is only going to get worse. And more what's clear is that we need a new kind of national conversation between the major political parties, between not just the political parties, but also including other groupings, to try and find a way through in a more unified way. But ZANU-PF being what it is, it's not even going to move in that direction. It's going to feel that it can consolidate and try and rule with a kind of combination of this repression and people's fear that if they carry on going on the streets, there's going to be more killings, more murders, and they're going to think they're going to be able to sustain that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they can.
No, I mean, I was just going to say the genie's out of the bottle. I mean, in Bulawayo, it was so interesting to see. I mean, it reminded me so much of the tipping point in South Africa. The police were shooting tear gas, and people were literally taking the tear gas canisters, picking it up and throwing it back at the police and advancing constantly.
Indeed.
And you had the police eventually saying, we actually can't control these crowds. We're going to go back to the police station. So there's an emboldened atmosphere amongst the Zimbabweans that was curtailed, if you like, by the way in which Mr. Mnangagwa tried to choreograph the takeover. And it's almost as if we're seeing the residual protest that ought to have preceded a removal of Mugabe that is only beginning to happen now. And it could actually sweep the entire political elite out of the way. If that happens, is the opposition mature enough, united enough, clear enough on a way forward to be actually able to take a hand of this of the situation? And what is going to be expected of countries like South Africa? Because whether we like it or not, I mean, Zimbabwe and South Africa are inextricably linked. The impact we feel immediately in the country.
Absolutely. I think the worry is that there's also serious problems in the opposition.
Yes.
The manner in which the succession took place, some of the strategies that they used during the election period, and we're not seeing any clear alternatives coming out of there. That's why I think the role of South African SADC is once again going to become important. This issue has to become a regional issue again.
Yeah.
The region, South Africa, have to take a lead again and to try and inject some new discussion going. Because as things stand, as you say, these young people on the street, they don't belong to the old forms of trade union structures. These are youngsters who in the past you'd never see structures burning in Zimbabwe.
Mm.
And that way, you're right, it does resemble what has happened in South Africa. This is a new form of activism that has emerged, where the sense of the public, the sense of public ownership of those issues is beginning to go into demise. These are youngsters who don't feel that they have a sense of ownership in the public sphere.
And they have nothing to lose.
Correct. They have nothing to lose. They can barely survive. Their families are in trouble. And they're less afraid of the repressive regime than in the past.
This is the one thing that is fascinating. I mean, the Zimbabwean backlash was so bad previously. The beatings, the detentions, the killings, the assassinations and so on. But it looks as if that as a tactic on its own without a political strategy is not going to be able to contain the dissatisfaction. I mean, if you have policemen and women who are not being paid, if you have the army that's not going to be paid, if you have nurses, doctors and teachers that are not going to be paid or that are paid but can't use their cars, for example, to get to work because they simply can't afford it. The remaining public infrastructure basically just caves in, it collapses.
Absolutely.
You know, and that has to be the tipping point. And I mean, Zimbabwe is literally there. If we're talking about a national conversation, Mr. Raftopoulos, will there be the maturity to initiate this by Zimbabweans themselves, or are they going to have to get the intervention from SADC? And SADC's plate is full. If you look at what is happening in the DRC, for example, if you look at what is happening in some of the other African countries, what is happening in Mozambique, I mean, the meeting in Ethiopia is going to be a tough one. To what extent do you think SADC is going to be able to not just intervene, but do it appropriately, considering that it has quite a lot on its regional agenda?
Yeah, I think that's the real challenge. The problem at the moment is there are groupings in Zimbabwe who are trying to bring the parties together in a discussion, church groups, concerned citizens groups. There hasn't been much progress, and they've been trying for over a year. But unfortunately, it's going to need some positioning on the part of the region. I know that they've got their hands full, especially with the DRC.
Yes.
But without that, I don't see at this time ZANU-PF moving towards a national discussion, because their issue is that still they want their legitimacy to be recognized. And that's the position that the opposition are not going to move towards without more serious concessions.
Now, of course, the fact that the political leadership in Zimbabwe seems to be immature on both sides creates, again, as I've said earlier, a vacuum. We have groups like the church, we have groups like the flag movement that has tried to come in. But is there any cogent group of people that can kind of almost fill that gap, that enjoys the respect of both opposition and ZANU-PF, that can initiate a dialogue and a national conversation that has some kind of integrity, even if it's a fragile one?
Well, as I said, closer to that, maybe some of the church leaders who have contacts with both sides. But their efforts so far have not produced much fruit, which doesn't mean that the efforts must not continue.
Yeah.
And I think there needs to be more push to try and find those credible figures, to try and build up the momentum that's been created by these latest demonstrations, to see if we can get some initial discussion going. And maybe that can also just be pushed a little bit more by some efforts from SADC.
Now, when we had the elections, I mean, we had the opposition party, I think, quite unstrategically declaring themselves the winner and saying if they don't win, the election would be illegitimate. And in a way, they almost disarmed themselves from an investigative process that could establish that in fact. And so they were kind of seen as quite immature. Mr. Mnangagwa delayed the results, but eventually, you know, it came through. What needs to happen in the opposition for them to cohere more thoroughly, and for a leadership that is you know, that has a grip on the situation to develop, and that has respect across the factions? Does Mr. Chamisa, for example, enjoy the respect of all the factions within the MDC, within the opposition broadly? I mean, there's a whole lot of groupings that have also sprung up. Does he have the kind of charisma? Does he have the chutzpah? Does he have the grit to actually be able to pull people together? Or do you think that they overplayed their hand so much in the run-up to the release of the elections that they're still trapped there?
Look, I think the history of divisions in MDC goes back a long way.
Yeah.
And those divisions are there still, not just those who have split apart, but even the factionalism within the existing MDC. And a lot of that also has to do with the fact that politics, we're in a situation where there's no formal employment in the private sector. It becomes a place for jobs.
So
people are not just fighting for value, they're fighting for a place for employment in a future state or a future parliament.
Mm.
And so this is also central to the problems that are going there. I think that there's obviously Mr. Chamisa, in terms of the vote, I mean, he got double the vote that Mr. Tsvangirai got, so he's clearly got a large following in terms of the vote.
Yes.
But in terms of how he can galvanize different groups, he's yet to show that he can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a challenge that he has to face now, and see how in the face of this broad crisis that's deepening, how he can bring groups together to confront this authoritarian regime and help to push them towards some kind of a national dialogue.
Now, of course, I mean, the majority of Zimbabweans are actually outside of the country. A lot of the intelligentsia, such as yourself, are not there because it became impossible for you to be there. What is the role that Zimbabweans in the diaspora and everywhere they find themselves in can play, if any? Do they go home and risk it? Do they put pressure on from outside? Is there any role, if any, for those who find themselves in the diaspora, particularly among the middle classes and the intelligentsia?
Yeah, look, I think there's still a role for them to play, as they have done in the recent past, which is putting pressure on the governments where they are living. I think many of those, especially in the middle class, who are there now are unlikely to move back fully to Zimbabwe at this time. They have just no trust in the politics of the state, and they're likely to straddle rather than move one way or the other. And I think that, therefore, the pressure that they can bring on the places where they're living in terms of getting those governments to have a look at what can be done to push for a dialogue, that, I think, is still an important role.
Absolutely. Final question on the ZANU-PF balance of forces. Mr. Chamisa, the chief of the army, not sitting around the same table necessarily. What do you think is likely to happen in ZANU? The so-called group of 40, will they be able to regroup? Will they be able to re-emerge? What is ZANU's prospects, and who do you think will emerge the strongman, if you like? Do you think Emmerson will be able to hold on to that position and defy the head of the army?
Look, I think that the factionalism in ZANU is still very deep. Those who supported Mugabe are still there, even if they're quiet now, and some of them in exile. I don't think that at the moment anybody's going to push Mnangagwa out. I don't think Chiwenga has any, would have the kind of gravitas anyway to move the situation forward in any way. And so for the moment, I just see Mnangagwa consolidating his position, but in a context where the broader crisis makes that consolidation very fragile.
If you look at Africa, Professor Raftopoulos, I mean, a decade ago, we were talking about Africa rising. We were talking about 10 of the world's fastest economies in the continent. At the moment, you're looking at a very fragile Zimbabwe, a very fragile DRC. You're looking at al-Bashir in Sudan, literally facing a real onslaught on power. We've just had an explosion in Kenya with al-Shabaab. South Africa is going into an election where the ANC is far from guaranteed to necessarily win convincingly at the polls. A very, very different Africa.
Yeah, I mean, I personally always thought the Africa rising narrative was exaggerated. I think that the kind of long-term structural problems in the African economies were always apparent, and that whatever brief increase of productivity or rise in the economy that was there was always a very fragile one. But as you say, what we're looking at now is many regimes facing huge challenges, and certainly in Southern Africa, the liberation movements, their narrative is increasingly being eroded by the problems that they're facing. And the longevity of that is looking increasingly problematic. The challenge, of course, is that the alternatives to that are also looking very, very problematic.
Absolutely. It's not looking good at all. There's very, very slim pickings on the horizon. Professor Brian Raftopoulos, always a pleasure speaking with you, a veteran political analyst and director of research and advocacy for the Zimbabwean Center based in the Western Cape, speaking to us there about the situation in the country and also the prospects for a national dialogue and conversation, and just the kind of granular divisions that we see both in the opposition as well as ZANU-PF, and then the young people that are simply not afraid. They've got nothing to lose. They've got no jobs. They've got no money. They've got no food. And they, of course, the ones that are battling the police on the streets every day.